You owe your musical career in no small part to Mama Cass Elliott from the Mamas and the Papas. She discovered you while you were a ski instructor in Colorado. Would you tell us more about that?
Oh, sure. I was doing the skiing thing in Aspen, and I was also sitting in with a lot of bands at night because I love playing the bass. And a group came to town from Hollywood called the Candy Store. And so they were playing like a really big hall. One afternoon I went by and I was just kind of sitting around and I was listening to the band because they just let me in to listen. And I asked if maybe I could just sit in for a song. And they said, sure, why not? And so I got out and started playing with them, and they really liked me a lot. And so they started having me come down for their shows at night and come up and sit in. And then I met the entourage that was with them, and one of the people in that entourage was Mama Cass. She and I got friendly. She talked about maybe getting some skiing lessons, and I said, absolutely. And I took her up on the mountain and started teaching her how to ski. And we became very good friends, very good friends. And at one point, she just turned to me one day and said, Doug, you know, I know so many bands that need good bass players in Los Angeles. Why don't you come back to L.A. with us? And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I said, okay, I think I will. So I actually went back to the ski school that I was teaching at a couple of days later and turned in my skis, my parka and everything, and bid them farewell. And I jumped on the plane with Cass, and we went to Los Angeles. And that's how I ended up in L.A.
The very same plane with Mama Cass.
No, absolutely. She was sitting right next to me.
Wow. You joined the band Brain Train, which eventually became Clear Light, when you met two members of that band, Bob Seale and Dallas Taylor, sandwich boarding for a bass player on the street in Los Angeles. How did that chance meeting come about?
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. There was this this place in L.A. called Cantor's Delicatessen. I'm sure it's still there. It's historic. And I was living in a basement in an apartment somewhere in Hollywood. A very nice guy named Bud Mathis, who was the manager of that building, we met somehow, and he had an apartment in the basement, not even really an apartment, more like a cot, but I ended up staying there. And I was always looking around for opportunities to meet musicians. Bud actually heard me on the porch a couple times playing his guitar, playing bass lines. And he would just sit and listen, and you know, it's a good night. But one night he said, you know, you really should be playing bass. You should have your own bass. And about 2 weeks later, he asked me to come to his apartment upstairs. And I walked in, and there was a Gibson bass and a small bass amp sitting leaning against his couch. And he said, Doug, these are for you, because you should be playing bass, and I'm going to help you get started. And that's the biggest gift I've ever gotten in my life, absolutely. And I started living in that basement and just playing day and night, day and night, day and night. And so I started going out and looking for people to play with. And I heard through somebody, just by wandering around on the Sunset Strip, talking to different musicians, that there was this big gathering down at Cantor's Delicatessen in the evenings, late night, like after like 10, 11 o'clock at night. They'd just gather out in front of the delicatessen and just mill around. Everybody would just be talking, and some of them had little signs on their pocket carrying a sign with them, saying, looking for lead singer, looking for guitar player. And I saw these two guys coming through with a sign, we need a bass player. So I walked up and I started talking to them. And it turned out to be Dallas Taylor and Bob Seale. And they, after we talked for maybe a half an hour, they said, well, you know what? We have a car here. let's get in the car here and let's go pick up your bass and your amp. And why don't you come out to Manhattan Beach and check out our band house? And I said, absolutely. We went and just did just that and ended up in the group called The Brain Train. It was two drummers, one bass, two guitar players, and a female lead singer at the time. But we were all living in this one little house, and most of us were sleeping on the floor. And that's how I ended up in The Brain Train. And eventually the female singer left to join another band that went on to become very well known. I'm not sure what the name of it was. But Clear Light, The Brain Train started playing around the area and the beaches and everything. And then we got heard by a record exec. And the next thing we knew, we were assigning to Elektra Records.
Was it Jack Holtzman by any chance?
Well, Jack was the president. He was the main guy. I'm not sure who actually signed us. It may have been that our sometime manager took our tapes to Elektra. I really don't have a clear recollection of how that happened, but we did end up on Elektra Records.
Clear Light's first gig under that name was at Los Angeles' First Lovin' at Griffith Park. You were the opening act for the Steve Miller Band, The Grateful Dead, and The Other Half. Tell us more about that.
Okay, are you talking about the First Lovin' that they ever did?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that was a pretty historic moment for all those bands involved. It was the first time anything like that had happened. And it was an absolutely fantastic experience for something that was happening for the first time. So many people showed up for it, and they had set up a great stage, great sound systems, and the event went so well. And it was the beginning of something that would become a staple of those years in the 60s. And I'm very proud to have been there. On the first one.
Jimi Hendrix once sat in on bass on one of Clear Light's gigs. Could you tell us more about that?
Sure. I guess he introduced himself to us. We were playing different shows around, I think it was New York. Yeah, in New York. And I remember looking out into the audience, and I saw what I thought looked like Jimi Hendrix. And I went back and I told the guys in the band, you know, we want a break. I said, I think Jimi Hendrix is in the audience. And they said, nah, no way, no way. So a couple days later, somebody in the band says, you know what, I think you're right. I think Hendrix is in the audience. And then he just came walking into our backstage dressing room and introduced himself, said hello, and you know, he really liked the band, and he became kind of a regular. He would show up a lot, and he started getting up on stage and playing with us. And I remember more than once he asked if he could get up and play bass, and of course it was fine with me. And I had a beautiful Gibson B3 violin, solid body violin bass. I guess he really liked it. That became quite a fun thing for us.
I can imagine it must have been.
Oh, yeah.
Clear Light also had a cameo role in the movie The President's Analyst. Tell us how you got that gig.
Okay. The movie company was looking for what they described as something, you know, something that represents those 60s bands. And somehow they came and saw us. They also went and saw The Grateful Dead, among other bands, among many, many other bands. And for some reason, they decided that they wanted to use Clear Light. And it was great fun. Have you ever seen the film?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's very campy. And the guy who was the star, James Coburn, he turned out to be a fantastic guy, very personable, very fun, and very hip. We were really happy to be around him. And yeah, that was a nice springboard for Clear Light.
Now let's talk about your career as a studio bassist for The Doors. You started while you were still with Clear Light. You played on Strange Days, Waiting for the Sun, and Soft Parade. How did you land that position?
Well, it was Paul Rothchild, the producer of The Doors. He brought me to meet The Doors because he also ended up being our producer in Clear Light. And so he was working on both projects at the same time. And one day he was at the Clear Light house. We had a big mansion up in Hollywood Hills. Excuse me. and he just mentioned, I'm working with this other band, and they've kind of been looking for a bass player, and they can't seem to find anybody. Would you be interested in coming to meet them? And I said, sure. Who are they? And he goes, well, they're a band that's called The Doors. And I said, sure, great. Yeah, I just the more people I could play with, the better. I was an absolute, and still am, a music fanatic. So a few days later, Paul came and picked me up. We drove up into Laurel Canyon, up those winding roads, and that ended up at this little kind of wood, it's kind of a wood cabin duplex. It was small, but it was very nice. There was a beautiful view from there, and we walked into the duplex that was on the right, the right half of it, and there was some guys sitting there, and I recognized them because I realized that I had seen them at a club called the Sea Witch. Yeah, that was on Sunset Strip. Well, I had never been sure of their name, but I when I saw them at the Sea Witch, I was really impressed. And to be honest, there was maybe four people in the club, and then there was me and four friends, so there was a total of about nine people in the place. And Jim had his eyes closed half the time. He was facing away from the audience. Excuse me, one second.
Hope you're okay.
Oh, I'm fine. And so yeah, so Jim was singing, was up there with his eyes closed. He looked like he was in his own world. Eyes closed, half the time he was facing away from the band, and there was this very competent keyboard player with big horn-rimmed glasses. That kept his head down into the keyboard. And then there was this kind of jazzy drummer, and then there was this guitar player that played with his fingers. He didn't even use a pick, which was kind of odd, because everybody used picks back then. And they had their own sound, they had their own style. I really liked them, but I do remember thinking that the guy, the lead singer, was a little bit strange. So anyways, we went up to this that house. I walk in, and there's Ray and Robbie and John. No Jim. And so we start talking, and I said, well, you know, hey, yeah, you know, you're interested in coming maybe to play with us, so let's try some songs. So they just played me some ideas, some songs, right off the top of their heads. I guess they had it planned. And I picked up on the ideas real quick, and we started having a great time. Excuse me, one second. And then everybody's looking real happy. And then Jim walks in. And so Ray says, well, let's go through a couple of these songs. I wish I could remember which songs they were, but it was things like it might have been, Strange Days or Hello, I Love You. I'm not sure. But we did some songs. And at the end of it, they just said, you want to come and record with us? And I said, absolutely. And said, said, see you later. And I jumped back in the car with Paul, and we went back to the Clear Lighthouse. And that's how I met the guys.
Jim Morrison was, among other things, the guy you rode to work or clubs with. Sometimes it was with him and his girlfriend, Pamela. What was he like as a person, and what was it like working with him?
Oh, he was one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my life. He at this period of time in his life, he was very lighthearted. He was always smiling and when it came time for me to go to the studio, I was still at the point where I didn't even have a vehicle. So Jim would come and pick me up at the Clear Lighthouse. And it was pretty much most of the time it was Jim. Sometimes, a few times it was Paul, but most of the time it was Jim. He was driving a Volkswagen. And one day, one of the girls, it was one of her, you know, groupies, I guess, walked into the Clear Lighthouse and said, "Who is that god sitting outside in that car?" And she didn't know who he was, but she sure does now.
Yes, I read that in the excerpt from your book.
Yeah, now that's exactly, because that's exactly what happened. Very, very strong memories of all that.
You were offered a permanent position with the Doors, but elected to stay with Clear Light. What led to that decision?
I question it every day, but back then, Clear Light was we were a very strong family. It was more than a band, we were also a family. And the thought of leaving my buddies to go play with anyone else was just out of the question at the time. So I did agree to go and play on all the records, and we did quite a few albums together. But I wish I had, I'll be honest with you.
I hear you. After Clear Light disbanded, you set off on your own to found the jazz rock band Dreams with Randy Brecker. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, okay. I met a guy named Jeff Kent. He was a keyboard player. And while I was in New York with Clear Light, and so we decided to try to do something in New York. I left L.A., flew out to New York, and was shacking up somewhere, I don't remember. And we just started to put a band together. First it was just me and Jeff, and then Jeff Kent, and then we found a great rehearsal spot. What was the name of it? Oh, it's on the tip of my tongue. But anyways, it was down in Soho, back when Soho was like going to the jungles of Vietnam. It was like just old beat up warehouses. So we started rehearsing in this little beat up loft, and then we started bringing drummers down. And we went through quite a few drummers, and one of them was became the drummer for Bon Jovi, believe it or not. I can't
really
remember his name. Pardon me?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. He was, and we auditioned him, and he was fantastic. But then we met Billy Cobham. And Billy Cobham was just off the charts. And we just decided right there that we were going to go with Billy. And it was just going to be a power trio, just a B3 bass and Billy Cobham on drums. And it sounded incredible, absolutely incredible. We were on the fourth floor in a Soho loft and no air conditioning. And so we'd leave the windows wide open at night when we're rehearsing. And people would actually make that fourth floor walk up, come up and say, "Who are you guys? You know, what? When are you guys going to have a record?" So we were going to stay a trio, and then someone came up with the idea to maybe add some horns, and somebody knew Barry Rogers, who was a great trombone player. And we met with Barry, and he brought us Randy Brecker and Michael Brecker. So now we have three horn players and a power trio, which also was pretty interesting. But before you knew it, we also had a guitar player. And then shortly after that, we got signed with Columbia Records. And then halfway through our album, everyone decided that we also needed a lead singer. So we added Eddie Vernon on vocals. And it was one of the first jazz rock bands. I think we were a bit more jazzy than groups like Blood, Sweat, and Tears in Chicago. But we weren't as commercial. And so they really left out front and we ended up but not doing that well. We had that first album out, toured a lot. People loved us. Miles Davis was a big fan, by the way, the trumpet player. And then Jeff and I left the band to go do another project, and they went on with they added Will Lee and Don Gralnick on keyboards, and they went on to do a second record, and it didn't really do much, and then everything fell apart after that.
You say in your book that you were breakfast buddies with Bob Dylan. How did you meet him?
Yeah. I was living on Bleecker Street in the Village, and I had met this gorgeous, gorgeous girl at a club called the Bitter End, I think it was called. Yeah, the Bitter End. And anyways, I was living with her on Bleecker Street, and there was a guy in the front of the apartment building that had a little photo shop. And so we became friends with him. And one day I'm standing in his little storefront, and he goes, "Oh, you know, Bob Dylan was just in here." And I looked at him. I said, "Yeah, right. Of course he was." And he said, "No, really." He says, "Bob Dylan lives right across the street, and he was just in here." And I said, "Well, why don't you? I'd really like to meet him. So why don't you see if maybe you could set me up to meet him?" He goes, "Okay." A couple days later, he calls me on the phone. He says, "Come on over, Bob's here." I walk in the door, and there's Bob Dylan standing at the counter. And we say hello. He's as friendly as can be, very down to earth. And we become friends, good enough friends that we would go out at night together and just go to some clubs, listen to music. Of course, it was crazy because he had so many fans out there following us around on the streets. And at one point, I remember we left the club and started walking down Bleecker Street, and a bunch of girls came out of the club and started following us. So Bob said, "Hey, let's just run." So we started running, and they started running after us. And he turned around and he goes, "Where were you when I needed you?" And we got away. And that was just the kind of person he was. He really was just a lot of fun. He would come and have breakfast with myself and my girlfriend of the time, Leia, who he also liked very much. She was a very attractive woman. And that was the story. You know, we just were neighbors. He lived right across the street, like they said.
On page 6 of your book, My Days with the Doors, you go over all the people you've met over the years, over your career. A who's who of 60s popular culture. Apart from Mr. Dylan, how did you get to meet so many influential figures?
Well, it was pretty much all by accident. For example, when I was living on the Upper West Side, in New York City, on West 77th Street, between West End and Riverside, I was walking home one night, and I saw a girl. It was winter, and I saw a girl all huddled up in a doorway, and she was sleeping. there. And I thought, well, you know, maybe she got lost or something, or was too drunk to make it home. But then I started seeing her around the neighborhood and realized this girl is out on the streets. And when I walked by real close one time, I noticed that she actually was very pretty. I never spoke to her. But I did see her around for a couple weeks, and then she disappeared, and I didn't think any more about it. About a year later, a bass player friend of mine said, oh, you know, by the way, I'm playing in this club uptown. I think it was called Cartoon Alley, way uptown. And he said, yeah, I'm playing with this girl, and she does kind of like reggae stuff, and why don't you come check it out? She's new. So one night I wasn't doing anything. I went up there and sat down in a little club there, and there's no one on stage. And then the band comes out and starts playing. And then they introduce this girl, and she comes walking out on stage. And she was absolutely stunning. And I looked and I realized that's the girl that I've seen in the neighborhood. And it was, of course, Madonna. And after their show, I went backstage and met her, and I asked her, you know, I recognize you from seeing you on the West Side. What were you doing out there sleeping in doorways? She said, well, my roommate and I really weren't getting along, and I just had to get out of there. And I guess she felt so strongly that she actually went out and lived on the street for a while. So it's just odd circumstances like that, things like that, that helped me meet some very interesting people.
You've done session work for quite a few acts. Apart from the Doors, could you name us some of the best and worst ones?
Well, let's see. I haven't really done a lot of session work. I ended up doing some session work with Carol King when she was putting together a song to give to the Monkees. And this guitarist named Danny Korchmar and asked me if I wanted to come and meet her. And she had become a fan of Clear Light. At some point, because I remember we had this rehearsal place in some place out just outside of LA, and someone showed up with this girl, and she would just kind of sit at our rehearsals very quietly and just listen, and I could tell that she liked me a lot. It turned out that it was Carol King, and so Carol and I became friends. Not really dating, but we became very good friends. And then a while later, I ended up going in and playing on one of her songs. It was called The Porpoise Song for the Monkees.
Ah, but from the movie Head.
Yes.
So you're partly responsible for that.
I guess. I played bass on it.
You also wrote Treat Me Right for Pat Benatar. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. I was doing a lot of songwriting. This is like in 1989. I had just come out of a group named Pierce Arrow. And Jeff Kent and I were the two of the main writers in that band. There was actually four writers. And so I ended up with a publishing deal with Columbia Publishing, which is April Blackwood Music. And so when everything blew apart, the band blew apart, I started writing on my own. And I would sit in my living room and just, you know, write song after song after song. And I came up with this song on an electric piano called Treat Me Right. And it was astonishing to me because a lot of the time, it takes a long time to pull a song together, and this one just seemed like it was just waiting in the air to be grabbed and played. And I sat down, and within about 20-30 minutes, the song was finished. I went and did a demo of it with a couple friends of mine, Jeff on keyboards, Jerry Murata, who was the Peter Gabriel drummer for many, many years. He was on drums, and I forget who played guitar. But anyways, that got recorded. It went to the publishing company, and it sat there for a while. And then a group called the Boxers, some group that never did anything. I heard that they wanted to record my song, so of course I gave permission, and they did a version of it. It went nowhere. And then things died down and nothing happened. And then out of the blue, I'm down in the Keys, the Florida Keys, playing bass with the guitar player from the David Bowie band. And I'm sorry, but his name escapes me right now. But we had like a little pickup band. What we'd do is just, throw together some songs. And then it was a full band, and then he was very connected, so he was constantly getting offers to go play here, play there. We ended up in the Florida Keys. It was a great, like, two-week, three-week vacation. And I'm out on a jet ski one day, and somebody starts yelling to me from the dock, saying, "Doug, there's a very important phone call for you." So I come back to the dock. I'm on my jet ski in my bathing suit, probably soaking wet. I go pick up the phone, and it's one of the guys from my publishing company, April Blackwood Music. And they said, "We just needed to check with you. There's this girl that wants to try doing your song. Her name is Pat Benatar. Is that okay with you?" And I just went, "Sure, fine, let her do it. Bye. I got to go jet ski." And I come back on my jet ski and took off. And then about 9 months later, I got a call from her record company saying, "Why don't you come on out and listen to what she did with it?" And I went up to the offices there, and I was pretty impressed. But I was even more impressed when it went out on an album that sold just millions and millions of copies. So it was a very nice experience for me.
I can imagine it must have been. Thank you very much for granting me this interview.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.